Tom Williams. Robert Poole says for most of the country, the longest war in the history of the United States has taken place largely out of sight. The casualties piling up in faraway Iraq and Afghanistan, while normal life continues on the home front with no war taxes, no draft notices, no gas rationing, none of the shared sacrifice of the nation's earlier conflicts. The one exception has been in Section 60, he says, a corner of Arlington National Cemetery, where more than 900 men and women have come to rest in the past decade. On this Veterans Day, we're going to be talking with Robert Poole, whose book, Section 60, Arlington National Cemetery, Where War Comes Home, is the biography of a five-acre plot where many of those killed in Iraq and Afghanistan have been laid to rest alongside service members from earlier wars. Using Section 60 as a window into the latest wars, Poole recounts stories of courage and sacrifice by fallen heroes. He explores the ways in which soldiers, comrades, friends, and families honor and remember those lost to war, carrying on with life in the aftermath of wartime tragedy. Robert Poole is an editor and writer whose assignments for Smithsonian and National Geographic have taken him around the world. His stories have appeared in New York Times, Washington Post, and Smithsonian. He retired in 2001 as executive editor of National Geographic and is author of Explorer's House, National Geographic and the World It Made, and On Hallowed Ground, the story of Arlington National Cemetery. And his latest book, as I mentioned, is called Section 60. Robert Poole joins us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio, and we welcome him to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Happy to be here.
And we thank VPR for helping us out here. I believe, Mr. Poole, you have an interview with them immediately after ours, so we appreciate you doing double duty today.
So happy to do it.
I'd like to start where you begin in this latest book. You spent a lot of time, of course, in Arlington. We'll get to On Hallowed Ground as well, if you're willing. But I was intrigued by an encounter you had, and you put this at the front of the book, with retired Navy Commander Kirk S. Lippold, who said, this is one of the few places you'd know we had a war going on. And I mentioned at the top of the show here, with the latest way we run wars and how we have our armed forces, as you write, for most of the country, the longest war in the history of the U.S. has taken place largely out of sight. But one of the places, of course, that you see there's a war going on is in cemeteries like Arlington.
Yes, that's certainly true. I think there are many advantages to the all-volunteer system that we have now. No draft. Everyone who goes to war goes willingly. So there are advantages to that, but I think one of the disadvantages is that when we do have a war, or wars, as we've done for the past 10 years, people who are going to war are called on to serve repeatedly, again and again, and I think they feel a certain sense of isolation, as if there's no shared sacrifice. It's not something that is felt across the board as it was in earlier wars, World War II, Korea, and even to some extent Vietnam. So you see this come into play in Section 60, and that's a place where you can go almost any day and find some evidence of the recent losses that we've experienced in Iraq and Afghanistan.
You've talked to many people, right? Many family members, loved ones. You've spent a lot of time there in Arlington and I guess lately in Section 60. Let's back up and tell us what Section 60 is. This is the newest portion of the cemetery?
Yeah, this is Arlington National Cemetery dates to the Civil War. And it is about 620 acres in extent. Of that 620 acres, there is this newer section, which is, the newer sections, as you would expect, are on the outer edges of the cemetery. So this is a section that's closer to the river. It's actually 14 acres in extent. There have been some reports, earlier reports, that it was 5 acres, but that's not correct. It's 14 acres. There are more than 900 people killed in Iraq and Afghanistan who were buried there. Of course, there are many, many, many more than that were lost in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, but the greatest concentration of people lost in those wars are in this part of Arlington. So it's a way to, if you take a walk through this part of the cemetery, you will meet people who had friends, relatives, sons, daughters killed in those wars, and you you find just by investigating the human story behind the tombstone, many, many different ways that, that people were brought to Arlington.
Well, how do you approach this? Of course, they, some people, I'm sure, want to just be left alone to be with their dead, but many, I would imagine, would want to talk about their loved one. You approach them and ask them to tell their story. How do you do that?
Well, I start by showing respect for the people who are buried there and the families who are visiting there. By, you know, it sounds stupid, but I did this very consciously. I would dress for the part, just as the honor teams do, who are seeing their comrades into the ground at Arlington. So that means, you know, a sober suit, a white shirt, a dark tie, shine shoes, just as a small gesture of respect to whoever is showing up at Arlington that day. And then you sort of get a feeling for who wants to be left alone and who is approachable. My standard was to not be very loud, not be very pushy, but if I met someone by a grave, let's say, who made eye contact and, you know, held it for a second, then I took that as a signal to begin a conversation. And it would begin with something like, well, can you tell me about this soldier or this Marine or, you know, whoever it is who is buried there? And usually that would lead to a conversation. Most people, because of this thing we discussed earlier, that they feel a bit isolated, a bit underappreciated. Most people were only too happy to talk about what happened to a comrade, a loved one, a brother, a father. This is what he did. This is how he got here. This is why he went into the Marines. This is what other Marines said about him.
Mm. Just want to underline before we go on. So I guess it sounds like a lot of the people that you've talked to would tend to be, I suppose, military families. They do feel some isolation, is what you're finding.
I think so, in general. Mm. And they, you know, they rely on, they very much rely on each other for support, and they do, you know, they help each other out, so that if someone has lost a son in Afghanistan and meets someone who's lost a son in Iraq, they'll make contact. They'll say, hey, I know what you're going through. I've been going through the same thing. Here's what I do to try to get through it. Tell me about your boy.
Right. And you tell some stories in the book. We'll get into some of those. You have a quote from Isabel Allende early in the book. People die only when we forget them. I think that's why we set up memorials, why we visit cemeteries, why we lay flowers.
Yes, there's this whole ritual, especially in a place like Section 60, where even when someone dies, those people, that person, has a life beyond the grave in some way. In the stories that friends tell about them, in the way they are remembered by families, families establish foundations to keep a son's name alive. They may have a golf tournament to support, you know, PTSD or something like that. So there are as many, you know, hundreds of new graves there are at Arlington Cemetery, there are that many ways of remembering the people who were buried there. And you see that time and time again in this part of Arlington.
And there are many ways that people, I guess, commune with their dead. You write about a family member who pulled up a lawn chair and it would sit there for a few hours.
Yes, people. That's very very common in this part of Arlington. People will come from maybe people who live a couple of hours away from the National Cemetery, or many hours away. They will come in maybe once a week and they make a ritual out of it. They bring lawn chairs. They set up camp. They may bring coffee. They may bring a drink, a beer or something for the person in the ground, pour the beer in the ground, pour some of the beer into themselves, and so goes the afternoon. Things that are considered a little strange elsewhere are quite normal at Arlington, especially this part of Arlington. People think nothing of talking to the gravestones, talking to the people in the ground as if they are there. And I think it is, it's a way of maintaining contact after someone has left, someone you may miss very much. You feel as if you have to do something. You have to make some gesture. This is a place where it's safe to do that.
And apparently, I wouldn't have known this unless I read your book, apparently fellow service members, if you served in boot camp together, you leave a penny. If you've, I guess, served in combat together, you leave a quarter.
Yes. And you, you know, almost any time you walk through this part of Arlington, you will see coins on top of the tombstones. Also, an adaptation of the Jewish practice of leaving a pebble on top of a tombstone. People have adapted that at Arlington Cemetery and expanded on it. So they will leave maybe three or four pebbles on top of a tombstone to show that someone still cares, that someone visited, and they will write messages on the pebbles. And the pebbles become much larger rocks sometimes. People leave, you know, letters written on rock, put either on top of the grave or in front of the grave, just as a way to say, we miss you, we're thinking about you.
Now, in many cases, especially with the with today's, the way we do the Army and Armed Forces volunteer, it's often generations of families, isn't it? And you have your first chapter. You talk to Joe Ripito, is that how you pronounce it?
Yes, Joe Ripito.
Who served two combat tours in Vietnam, and he's there on that particular day to bury his son, who served in, I think, Afghanistan.
Yes, the father was an Army Ranger in Vietnam. His son, and the father was Joe Ripito. The son was Russell Ripito, who also became an Army Ranger. And he was one of the first, among the first forces who went into Iraq in spring of 2003, parachuted in with a force of Army Rangers, and unfortunately was killed a few days later by a suicide bomber, which in some ways was a preamble to the sort of war this was going to be, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. That is, the new kind of war where your enemy may not wear a uniform, may seem to be part of the civilian population. You don't know where your enemy is. What happened to the younger Ripito, Russ Ripito? He and some of his men were maintaining a checkpoint near the Haditha Dam outside of Baghdad, and a car drove up. A woman got out of the car. She seemed to be pregnant, and she started begging for food and water. This young ranger, Russ Ripito, went down to arrange for one of his men to bring water and food to this woman who was in need, just to try to help her. And as he approached the car, boom, a huge car bomb was set off. It killed everybody in the car, and it killed Russ Ripito as well. He is the first combat fatality from the Iraq War to be buried at Arlington Cemetery.
Hmm. So it illustrates the cruel nature of how war changes, these improvised devices and the enemy who infiltrates and to say nothing of PTSD and suicides afterward. We'll get to talk about that. You have a chapter on that. If you just joined us, we're talking with Robert Poole. His latest book is called Section 60, That's a new corner of Arlington National Cemetery, where more than 900 men and women have been laid to rest in the past decade, warriors in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And the full title of the book, Section 60, Arlington National Cemetery, Where War Comes Home. We'll talk more about the rituals of war, which date back to the Greeks, and I guess beyond that. We'll talk about the current cruelties of war, including PTSD. That, says Mr. Poole, also is nothing new, although we've given it a name in current times. And we'll talk about the rituals and how we remember our dead, especially our military dead. We're talking on Veterans Day, and Robert Poole has joined us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. We would love to hear your story. If you have a loved one or family member who is serving or has served, maybe you yourself served or are serving, we'd love to hear your story at 1-800-826-1495. You can join us by email to upraccess@gmail.com. Tweet us to at Utah Public Radio, and we're on Facebook as well. More following the break.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the American Festival Chorus, joined by the USU Symphony Orchestra, with guest Congressman Chris Stewart presenting a Veterans Day concert in honor of our servicemen and women. Tuesday, November 11th at 7 p.m. in the USU Kent Concert Hall.
On Veterans Day, retired Army bugler Sergeant Major Woodrow English.
The first time I really had to do it was probably the toughest still to this day that I've ever had to do, and that was when I played for my father's funeral, and I wasn't planning on playing taps ever again. It was way too emotional.
The history and the meaning of taps on the next Performance Today from APM.
Tuesday morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Access Utah. My guest today for the hour is Robert Poole. He is author previously of On Hallowed Ground, The Story of Arlington National Cemetery. And his latest book is called Section 60, Arlington National Cemetery, Where War Comes Home. It's a biography of a five-acre plot where many of those killed in Iraq and Afghanistan have been laid to rest alongside service members from earlier wars. And in this book, Mr. Poole recounts stories of courage and sacrifice by fallen heroes, explores the ways in which soldiers, comrades, friends, and families honor and remember those lost to war, carrying on with life in the aftermath of wartime tragedy. So, Mr. Poole, a lot of this, of course, is about ritual, right? And of course, there's a very solemn ritual in Arlington. And you write about how the U.S., over time, has become very serious about this. No other nation, you write, goes to the effort the United States does to recover and pay tribute to its war dead. I wonder if you could talk about that. I guess, in part, this is a response to the way we did things during the Civil War, which was pretty haphazard.
Yes. We do. We keep evolving. We keep improvising. And to go back to the Civil War, it's hard to imagine today, but it's now thought that something like 900,000 people were killed in the Civil War. 900,000. By comparison, if we're talking about the Iraq and Afghanistan wars combined, it's 6,838. So let's say 7,000 people. So much of the Civil War took place around Washington, D.C. And Washington became, therefore, a hospital city. There was many as 50,000 people, Confederates and Union soldiers, wounded, brought to Washington and put in hospitals during the war. And many of them died there. We ran out of places to bury them. And it was all we could do to find places to get them into the ground in time. So as sort of an afterthought, we began burying people at Arlington Cemetery, 20, 30, 40 a day, with no ceremony, no bugler, no casket team, no firing party, none of that stuff that we associate with Arlington today, because we didn't have time for it. As the smoke settled, the war ended, Arlington began to develop as a national cemetery, and we developed as a country scarred by war, formed by war. We began to develop these rituals that you see at every Arlington service today. We also began with the next big war, the Spanish-American War, after the Civil War. We began repatriating people, those of our service members who were killed overseas. And in that war, it was Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines, and brought them back if their families wanted them brought home for burial. That began the tradition of not just leaving our people where they fell, but bringing them back, bringing them home, and making a ceremony out of it. That continues to this day, and you see that in Section 60 today.
Tell me about the ritual. And there are, what, there could be 20 of these burials, sadly, per day.
Well, let's talk about the repatriation
okay.
ritual.
All right.
It struck me in writing about Section 60. You may see a 19-year-old kid killed in Afghanistan next to a 22-year-old kid killed in Iraq, side by side at Arlington. But then next to them will be a 19-year-old killed in, let's say, Korea 60 years ago, 19 when he died, but missing all that time and just found, recovered, identified, which we can do now with DNA testing, and repatriated. So you will find in this part of Arlington not only people who have come there from Iraq and Afghanistan, our most recent wars, but from wars going back to World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, only because we've just found those people, made an ID, brought them back, and given them final honors, which they certainly deserve as much as anybody.
And then tell me about, maybe just pick out, one of the burials that you've witnessed. You've witnessed many.
Yes. Well, there's a certain routine that that happens. The service doesn't last very long, but everyone who's ever been to an Arlington service remembers it because of its dignity, and because of the ritual that's followed. Because of the way the service members turn out to take care of one of their own. So the tradition at Arlington is if you're a Marine, you die in service, you will be taken to your grave by Marines. They will carry the casket. They will fold the flag. They will fire the final salute over your grave. They will present the flag to your next of kin. And then one of their buglers will play taps. That's what you earn if you earn the right to be buried at Arlington. You will have these young people from your service, very well turned out, very well trained. They train for hours to make this look good. They're very conscious of their role in this. Every service does it. The ritual is essentially the same for all services, but each one does things a bit differently from the other. For instance, let's say an Army casket team, the guys who are carrying your casket, there will be an 8-member team, 4 on each side, carrying you from the caisson or a hearse to the grave across the grass at Arlington and staying with you until you go into the ground. The Marines, who do everything a little differently, instead of having an 8-person casket team, have a 6-person team. So they do more with less. And they are specially recruited to be, they're big guys. They do a lot of weightlifting. And you can see all the hours of training show up when they come to an Arlington service. You see other things that are in Arlington service too, small things but important things. Some of the services now have women on the honors details. The Air Force has a woman in charge of the firing party, which renders the final rifle salute at an Arlington funeral. The Air Force has a woman on the casket team. So she's there pumping iron with the guys, carrying her weight, you know, doing her job as a casket team member. So whatever you see happening in society at large, you also see playing out in services at Arlington Cemetery.
Mm. Often there be this Rolling Thunder motorcycle group.
Yes, there is a couple of groups. Rolling Thunder, which comes out for usually for Memorial Day, they have a big rally just to show their support for our veterans, for our troops, and they converge on, you know, hundreds and hundreds of motorcycles converge on Arlington. There's another group called the Patriot Guard, and they began another motorcycle group. A lot of them are Vietnam veterans. They began showing up at Arlington and at other national cemeteries when there were protests about gays in the military from the Westboro Baptist Church. The Patriot Guard made the decision to insert itself between the Westboro people and the service members who were being honored at Arlington and at other national cemeteries, just to maintain the dignity of the service. Nobody got past the Patriot Guard.
Hmm. Let me reintroduce my guest, if you just joined me. I'm talking with Robert Poole. He is author previously of Explorer's House, National Geographic and the World It Made, On Hallowed Ground, The Story of Arlington National Cemetery, and his latest book is Section 60, Arlington National Cemetery, Where War Comes Home. Mr. Poole has spent a lot of time in Arlington and has talked to a lot of families and loved ones of our honored dead. Appropriate topic of discussion for Veterans Day 2014. If you'd like to join the conversation, you certainly can at 1-800-826-1495. UPRAccess@gmail.com is our email, and we're on Twitter at Utah Public Radio. Also, you can join us on our Utah Public Radio Facebook page. Mr. Poole, you write about these rituals, purposes for the rituals, that in speaking their names, speaking of the dead, by recounting their acts of duty and valor, by suspending the other imperatives of life for a few minutes of ritual and reflection, these acts convey a sort of immortality upon the dead, who continue to live as long as they were remembered. And I guess we do this hopefully for all of our dead, especially for our military dead. And this happens not only in Arlington, of course, but in other burials. Military are honored. I wonder if you could talk a bit about why we do this. You write that with a few minor modifications, Arlington's rituals would be familiar to Thucydides or Homer.
Yes. Well, these are things that have been done for many, many years, as you suggest, back to Homer's time. The act of pouring wine or beer or booze into the ground over the grave of a comrade who's died in battle, that goes all the way back to Homer and Achilles pouring a sacrifice for his good friend Patroclus. This continues in Section 60 today. The act of bringing flowers to graves, I mean, that's as old as anybody can remember. That continues at Arlington, continues in Section 60, and is the basis of Memorial Day, which began after the Civil War. It used to be called Decoration Day because that was the day in May they wanted to be late enough for flowers to be in bloom and for friends to bring flowers to decorate the graves of those who had died in the Civil War. So that tradition continues at Arlington.
Hmm.
The tradition of firing a rifle salute is very deeply rooted in the military, a final salute. Some people mistakenly go to an Arlington service. They see members of a rifle team, seven members of a rifle team, fire three volleys. Seven times three equals 21. It's sometimes called a 21-gun salute. It is not. It's a three-rifle volley. The math works out to 21, which is sort of a magical number, but only the President of the United States and the nation itself are entitled to a 21-gun salute.
By the way, who's entitled to be buried at Arlington? What are the rules?
The rules are generally, and there are all sorts of footnotes, but anyone who was killed in action, let's say in Iraq or Afghanistan, anyone who has served the equivalent of 20 years or enough service, professional service, to retire from the military, anyone who has received Purple Heart or Bronze Star or the equivalent, those are the main categories, and then there is sort of a subcategory. Those are the requirements for an in-ground burial. There's a section of Arlington right next to Section 60 called the Columbarium, which is a complex of niches for cremated remains. Anyone who was honorably discharged from any of the military services can be buried in that, or interned in that part of Arlington. It's not really a burial, it's an interment, but the standard is slightly different if you're going into a niche rather than into the ground.
And I think most societies have had a something like the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, right? We honor those who we couldn't recover.
Yes, and that's a great tradition at Arlington Cemetery, which really began in World War One. There were so many people who, young men and women, mainly men, who went off to World War One, who never came home. They just disappeared, and the families really never knew what happened to them. Led by the example of Britain and France, after World War One, we created a Tomb of the Unknown Soldier at Arlington a few years after the Brits and the French did so. And the idea was to have that one soldier stand for all of the people who died in the war and lost their not only their lives but their identities. They mm-hmm. just disappeared. The idea was that it would help families find some sort of solace, some sort of resolution, in the hope that that person, that unknown soldier, might be my son, might be my husband. That was the idea behind it. With each successive war, we have found unknown service members and created spaces for them at Arlington Cemetery through the Vietnam War. But by the time Vietnam came around, the technology of DNA identification had become so sophisticated that we were able to disinter the Vietnam unknown, bring him out of the grave, and give him a name. He went back to St. Louis, his hometown, and is buried there today. So the unknowns are from World War One and World War Two. The Vietnam tomb is still there, but it is unoccupied. The people who know about this stuff say that it's unlikely we will ever have another unknown service member because the techniques of DNA ID are very, very good. So we make progress of a sort, I guess.
Yeah, it's certainly, I guess, more specifically comforting for that family, that's for sure. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Robert Poole will be with us for the final segment here, and his latest book is Section 60, Arlington National Cemetery, Where War Comes Home. Following the break, we're going to be talking about PTSD. Robert Poole writes that this is, it's a disorder that goes back to the Greeks and beyond them, earlier than them. We've given it a name in our time. And sometimes soldiers come home and the effects of war are delayed. And there are, unfortunately, soldiers in Arlington who committed suicide after unsuccessful bout with PTSD. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about this sacrifice, and we'll talk about more on this Veterans Day. We're talking about Arlington Cemetery, and specifically Section 60, which is the newest section of the cemetery, how we honor our dead, following the break.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Utah Humanities Council, empowering Utahns to improve their communities through active engagement in the humanities. Online at utahhumanities.org. And by Crum Brothers Artisan Bread in Logan. Open Monday through Friday until 3 p.m. A wholesale retail company dedicated to crafting a selection of artisan breads and pastries using old world techniques of preparation and baking. Information at crumbrothers.com.
Next time on Living on Earth, cutting down on driving to save our seas.
If 10% of vehicles in the U.S. drove just a mile less a day, it would eliminate 22 million tons of CO2, about the same amount that the ocean absorbs every day.
A simple idea to fight ocean acidification. I'm Steve Kerwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Wednesday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
A new debate over increases in legal minimum wage has now begun. Hear UPR commentator Richard Ratliff discuss how relationship economics could help resolve this debate. His commentary airs on Utah Public Radio.
Airs today at the end of Access Utah.
Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and thank you for your service, those of you who have served in the armed forces. It's Veterans Day. Our guest for the day is Robert Poole. His latest book is Section 60, Arlington National Cemetery, Where War Comes Home. Section 60 is a part of Arlington National Cemetery where military veterans killed in Iraq and Afghanistan have been laid to rest alongside service members from earlier wars. It's one of the newer sections. Using Section 60 as a window into the latest wars, Robert Poole recounts stories of courage and sacrifice by fallen heroes, explores the ways in which soldiers, comrades, friends, and families honor and remember those lost to war, carrying on with life in the aftermath of wartime tragedy. And Robert Poole joins us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio, so we thank VPR for their help. Robert Poole, as I've been going along here, I've been thinking about contrasting experiences of some. I'll use my own experience to those of others. My father served in World War II. He was in the Pacific in the Air Force, and he had military honors at his burial. But this was a scene, I think, somewhat different than the ones that you've witnessed with young men coming home from war. He was 93 when he died. The men of the honor guard from the American Legion were elderly men, and that's how we would wish it would be, right? Honors after a long life, after having served.
That's the way we want it to be.
But you, of course, and we witness this from time to time in local cemeteries, and of course at Arlington, and many times these are young men cut down, and for that family, that's a tragedy. That's a hurt. I don't know how you get over that.
Some people never do, but it's very difficult. One reason that young families still come to Section 60 after a loved one is buried there is to try to maintain contact with the person who has died, and the doctors who know about this sort of thing say that that's part of the healing process. You need to do that. It's good to do that. It's good to talk about the person who was killed and how he was killed. The more of that you can do, the more therapeutic it is.
And you've said early in the program you find that many people are very willing to talk. They do want to talk.
Yes. Yes.
And that's a part of, I guess, keeping the memory alive.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many mothers I talked to in Section 60 who said, my son told me the last time he went out, he said, just don't let everybody forget me. I don't want to be forgotten.
I want to talk about, you have a chapter about PTSD, and you opened my eyes here a little bit. I've always thought of this as a modern malady, but I guess we've given it in modern times a name, post-traumatic stress disorder. You take this back to, you say, as early as 490 BC, there was an Athenian soldier named Epizelus, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, facing the Persian enemies at the Battle of Marathon, went blind after a comrade next to him was struck dead. And this is as old as time, and very understandable. You see horrible things, you do horrible things, and it's hard to come back.
Yes, it is, and it's very difficult for some people to make that transition from wartime to peacetime. Why should it be easy? I mean, it's so remarkable, some of the things that these young men and women see in wartime today: suicide bombers, IED explosions, people blown apart right before your eyes. How do you see that and then come back and fit into society again without making much of a transition at all? I mean, this goes back to someone told me, someone pointed out, there was a great difference in your father's day and my father-in-law, also in the Pacific, also in World War II. Those guys went to war. They saw terrible things, but they would often be coming home on troop ships. It might take them 30 days, 60 days to get back from their deployment. They would have time during that process to talk to one another if they chose to consider the experiences they had had, to compare notes, to somehow deal with it and make a transition. Now it's a matter of days when you come home. So it's quite a shock for a lot of people. On the other hand, I should say, most service members who have been diagnosed with PTSD are okay. They do all right. They get over it. They get on with life. They survive. They're never the same, maybe, but they learn how to manage it. There are a few who don't make it, who just can't manage it. They can't deal with it. And they are the ones we lose, and some of those you see in Section 60.
You write about Master Sergeant Sean Mokaby?
Mokaby, yeah.
Mokaby, tell me about him.
Well, he was a very, very distinguished Green Beret. He had served many deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was with the Special Forces Group 10 out of Germany, and he's the guy everybody would turn to in a crisis, as the coolest customer, the most mature guy, the guy you'd want on your side, the guy you'd want behind you in a fight. After more than a decade of war, frequent deployments, he developed PTSD. He developed depression. There was no physical injury. There was nothing no outward sign that there was anything wrong with him. But basically, he couldn't control it. And he was a very capably trained medic, an Army medic, who could treat you or me with, you know, as a doctor would if we had some sort of injury in wartime. A very good guy, very capable guy, much loved by his family. They just couldn't do anything for him. And because he was a medic, and because he didn't want to be ostracized as some psycho case, he knew exactly how to answer the questions when someone would ask him, well, how are you feeling? What are you thinking about? He knew all the answers so that he didn't get categorized as a guy who couldn't function in the intense elite world of the Green Berets. And as a result, he got some treatment, but not really the extensive treatment he should have gotten. And he fell through the cracks. He killed himself. And he's there in Section 60 today.
Hmm. And that, yeah, we've heard other stories like this, haven't we? Do you think we're making progress with this, punching a hole in that stigma that I think some may still have?
I think so. I mean, I think so. At least if you look at how the Army and the other services are approaching this, they, from the top down, they have made the announcement that this is not a you shouldn't be stigmatized for this. This is something that should be treated. It should not hurt your career. If you know anyone who has PTSD, help them get the sort of treatment they need. On the other hand, the guys at the operational level, like Master Sergeant Mokabe, know in their gut you don't want to be categorized that way. So at the leadership level, yes, it's recognized. The leadership says get treatment, and treatment is available. But at the operational level, there's still some suspicion about what it will do to your career. Hmm. That was why Sean Mokabe didn't seek treatment, because he thought it would side rail his career.
We just have about a minute left. I want to mention you helpfully have a little part in the back of the book, How to Help. You say a portion of the profits from the book be donated to Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors, or TAPS. Tell me in 30 seconds about this group.
Well, this is a group that provides counseling for people who have lost loved ones in wartime, or people who are having problems with service members who are having problems with PTSD. It's a volunteer group. It's a very well-run organization. They will, if you need help, they have hotlines, and they help people get treatment. Both families and service members themselves.
Yeah, that's a good thing. We all want to know what to do, and here's a way we can help. TAPS.org is the place to go. The book is Section 60, Arlington National Cemetery, Where War Comes Home. The author is Robert Poole. Thank you so much.
Tom, thank you. Happy Veterans Day.
Happy Veterans Day. And again, thank you to all of our veterans for your service. Our thanks again to Vermont Public Radio, providing studio space for Mr. Poole there. Coming up tomorrow on the program, Secrets of the Greatest Snow on Earth. The subtitle is Weather, Climate Change, and Finding Deep Powder in Utah's Wasatch Mountains and Around the World, a science behind our greatest snow on Earth. And we'll talk about climate change and possible effects there. Jim Steinberg is my guest. That's coming up tomorrow. Hope you'll join me then. Thanks for listening today.
UPR commentator Richard Ratliff.
Serendipity happens. I recently rented a house to a new renter and his family. We discovered we really liked each other, and our negotiations turned out to be very unconventional. We somehow began assuming each other's position, he looking out for me and I looking out for him. It seemed we couldn't do enough for each other, eventually coming to very agreeable terms. I have been wondering how this model would work in other parts of our economy. We've been hearing overtures regarding an increase in the legal minimum wage in the United States. There are traditional, long-standing arguments from both sides of the issue. Surely, you've heard the growing debate. The problem with these arguments is not who is right or wrong. There is logical and practical merit to both sides. The problem is that both sides are approaching the argument from a power-based perspective. There is a battle. One side wins, one loses. The relationship between the sides is acrimonious, unhealthy. From previous commentaries, we know that unhealthy relationships, fostered by power-based behavior and institutions, are harmful and expensive. So, what is the correct answer to the question about an increase in the minimum wage? The principles of relationship economics would suggest that it matters less whether the minimum wage is increased or not, or whether there even is a legally mandated minimum wage. The most important factor in overcoming poverty and improving quality of life is the quality of relationships at work, in the home, in society, and with the broader political economy. Employers and their workers have roles to play in this script. If played well, no law at all is required. The key to more income is to improve productivity. The key to improving productivity is to improve relationships. The key to improving relationships is to improve the competence, integrity, good faith, and responsibility of those involved in the relationships. The answer lies, then, in greater competence, integrity, good faith, and responsibility of both employers and employees, acting on behalf of each other's interests. One tenet of relationship economics says that healthy relationships are more efficient than independent exchanges or unhealthy relationships. That is, better relationships increase prosperity. Worse relationships hurt prosperity. The plight of the poor is better addressed by cultivating mutually beneficial relationships between poor workers and their employers, and I should add, everyone else, at home, at work, with government, and in general society. Specifically regarding a minimum wage, it seems that the problem could be solved by changing attitudes. Both sides prosper by assuring in good faith their mutual benefit, looking out after each other's welfare as well as their own. I wonder what would happen if they were to assume each other's position, the employer negotiating for the employee and the employee for the employer. Free markets operate by fair dealing and good faith. Some people argue that everyone must protect his own interests because no one else will. We can change that idea. Consider the relationships. This is Richard Ratliff. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, this is folk singer Michael Jonathan inviting you to tune into our broadcast on this station. We have new lore plus an amazing folk singer, Joshua James.
I've got $2.5 underneath my bed. Once for my baby.
It's music and conversation on this week's broadcast of the Wood Songs, Old Time Radio.
Friday night at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
On NPR News, it's all about the story.
People can surprise you anytime.
The people behind movies, books, and music.
Music is like a Rorschach test, you know, when people hear what they want to hear.
I'm Arun Roth, the new host of All Things Considered from NPR News, now coming to you every weekend from NPR West in Southern California.
Weekend afternoons at 4 on Utah Public Radio.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.
Thank you for listening to Access Utah on Utah Public Radio, service of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. Up next, we have the Splendid Table, and you've been listening to Access Utah.